Good morning, Oregon.
Thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Full details are at offbeatoregon.com. Check it out. But first, sit back and relax. Let me tell you the story of the Chinese smuggler who saved a woman and her baby and then just vanished like a puff of smoke in the air. Why would he do that? Well, because attention wasn't good for a guy like that. This story was first published on March 5th, 2011, under the headline, Chinese Smuggler Saved Woman and Her Baby, Then Vanished. Here's the story. Cheng was on his way to a southern Oregon mining outpost one evening, during the heyday of the California Gold Rush, when he saw the wagon. It was slumped down on the road, hunched over a broken axle. But it obviously had only recently been abandoned. Its canvas cover was still in fine shape. It would make a good shelter for the night, he thought. He pulled open the flap. A terrified scream rang out. Peering inside, Cheng saw a starving, frightened woman holding a tiny newborn baby. She soon calmed down when she saw her visitor was just a mild, unassuming Chinese man dressed in rags. Cheng did not look in the least bit dangerous. He didn't look like much of anything, really. That was the secret of his success, and probably the reason he was still alive. Cheng opened his bag and started pulling things out. Food, of course, was the first order of business, but Cheng also had a wide assortment of herbs and extracts used for traditional Chinese medicine, so he brewed up a strengthening decoction for the woman and her baby. They would need their strength to get out of the predicament they were in. Their wagon axle had broken a week before, and the woman's husband had left, taken the horses, and set out to find help. There had been no sign of him since. Why he had taken both horses instead of just one wasn't clear. Perhaps he wanted to avoid drawing attention to the wagon with his little family inside. In any case, they couldn't wait for him. So as soon as the woman had her strength back, Cheng guided her to the nearest town. He stayed just long enough to make sure she was safe there, staying with the local stabler's family while waiting and hoping for her husband to be found. Then Cheng vanished into the night like a phantom. The last thing he wanted was attention of any kind, good or bad. If he stayed in town, he could count on both. Gratitude for saving a life mixed with suspicion that he'd had something to do with the husband's disappearance. It didn't matter. Any kind of publicity could be deadly for him. Cheng was a courier for the frontier Chinese community. During the gold rush, as many as 20% of miners in southern Oregon and northern California were Chinese. They worked the rejected tailings of less patient miners, getting surprising amounts of gold out of them. They tried to be as inconspicuous as they could, and they lived in little segregated camps in the field, hoping a combination of invisibility and numbers would protect them from drunks, bullies, and robbers. And they needed all the protection they could get. In frontier American society, the law offered them almost nothing. In theory, it treated all alike, but in practice, it covered Chinese immigrants only barely and in the most egregious cases, such as the massacre of 34 miners in Hell's Canyon in 1887. A murder here, a robbery there, few non-Chinese people cared, and that included sheriffs and judges. So Chinese miners couldn't just pack their gold dust up and ride to Portland to buy things with it. They were too tempting a target. To get their gold out of the field and buy things they needed, Chinese herbs, exotic dried seafoods and vegetables, even opium, they turned to professionals like Cheng. Cheng was part of an elite group of what you might call blockade runners. In effect, he was a smuggler, just not an illegal one. Here's how Cheng would run the blockade. On a visit to a camp, Cheng would pick up the miner's gold and bring it to one of the two major Chinatowns, San Francisco and Portland. There, the gold would be handled by trusted shopkeepers, divvied out on different miners' accounts, sent home to family members in China, used to buy supplies. Cheng would then return with the supplies, and it was on such a trip that he came across the starving woman. To deliver safely such valuable cargo took a special kind of skill. Quote, "He was very cautious," Cheng's descendant, Dave Cheng, told magazine writer Robert Joe Stout in an interview, "and never wore good clothing or let on in any way that he was carrying thousands of dollars concealed among his rags." The younger Cheng, a San Francisco resident, told Stout his ancestor made a point of not paying cash for things on the way. He'd trade labor for what he needed, like a 1930s hobo working as a deckhand to earn passage on a ship, shoveling out someone's stables in exchange for permission to sleep in them for the night, that kind of thing. And Dave Cheng's memories of family stories are probably the best documentation we'll find of the exploits of his remarkable ancestor and his colleagues. The fires that broke out after the 1907 earthquake hit San Francisco's Chinatown especially hard, and most of their records are now lost. We still don't have basic information about how many Chinese people there were on the West Coast, or what they were dying from. It's possible that entire pogroms were carried out in the hills of gold country, and no one knows about it today. It's also possible, almost certain in fact, that many more deeds of heroism and compassion done by Chinese pioneers have been utterly lost to history. As for the woman in the wagon, her fate has mostly been lost to history too. But though through discreet inquiries, Cheng was able to learn that her husband never did reappear, she finally gave up and moved with her baby back to Tennessee with her parents. That's it for today's episode. And if you're listening for the first time and want more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get it all at our central website, our anchor page, which is at offbeatoregon.com. That's the complete catalog. There's about 190 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and also to the Facebook page and Twitter feed in case you'd like to join the conversation. The website's also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which for today's episode include works by Robert Joe Stout and Sylvia Sun Minnick. Our theme music is a track titled Old Man's Waltz by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis, drop me a line and let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. I'm proud to offer this podcast under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. That's it for today. Tomorrow we'll talk about Crater Lake and how it was saved by an Albany newspaper man, the founder of the Albany Herald, who fought for about 20 years to get that lake set aside as a public park and finally won that fight. In the process, unfortunately, he introduced a fishery to the place, which people now wish that he had not done. But the good news is you can fish there for free. Look for that story after about 6 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, and in the meantime, go fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.